You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. We return to the world of Bigfoot as author Maxim Purik returns to discuss his latest book, The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot. Is it a flesh and blood creature? Perhaps an alien visitor? Is it transdimensional? Or is it some kind of lost human ancestor? The question of Bigfoot continues to fascinate tens of thousands of people from all around the world. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. A big thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support the show with your contributions. It is greatly appreciated. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise site is available via TeePublic, and you'll find the link for that in the show notes too. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Mr. Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. So, let's join Maxim to delve into some of the stranger theories that surround Bigfoot and beyond. The conundrum of Bigfoot continues to enthrall thousands from around the world, and each year sees no reduction in the obsession. In his latest book, The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot, author, rock journalist and psychologist Maxim Furyk finally embraces his lifelong passion on the search for the totem of cryptozoology. Maxim, welcome back, my friend. How are we?
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, I was just saying that we chatted a couple of months ago, and thank you so much for having me back. This is great. It's so amazing to me to be able to speak to the folks in the UK, you know, from over across the ocean, you know what I mean, with the technology. I mean, it's so cool. I mean, I'll never get over it, and I just think this is so great. And again, thank you for the, you know, for the opportunity. This is just like wonderful. So thank you.
Hey, it's always nice when somebody wants to come back as well, Maxim. So thank you.
Okay, good. Okay.
I mean, obviously, as I said in the introduction, Maxim, you've had a lifelong interest in the big guy. I think it's quite strange how the theory, the concept, the belief in Bigfoot can really seem to get its hooks in people from all around the world, as I've said. Obviously, North America has Bigfoot and Sasquatch and certain variations in different states. Some of the lower states, especially in the US, have their personal versions of it. Some you know more, better than others in regards to, say, the skunk ape or the folk monster over in Arkansas. But you've also got Yetis, Yerins, Almastis, Yowies. I mean, recently, there's been a big spate of sightings down in Patagonia with the Argentinian Bigfoot, which is the Ulcamar, which hasn't been reported about a lot in the last sort of 30 years, but there was a massive, prior, strangely enough, to the big Bigfoot flap in the States in the late 50s, when it all kicked off, in Argentina, in Patagonia especially, there were loads of reports late 1940s into the 50s all about their version. And so it's amazing how, for a creature we don't technically have a physical body of, how this search completely takes over people. And obviously with your book and your insight into it, coming at it on a psychological point of view, Maxim, I would imagine it's fascinating to see the power the creature has over people.
Yeah. Well, you could say that the creature has that power over us, but I think it's just the power of the human mind. You know, like we have a need to know. Yes. There's a bit of the Indiana Jones in all of us. We have to find the Holy Grail. We have to be the reach the top of the mountain. So I think that drive, that curiosity is a part of us. I think that we are motivated by fear and curiosity in equal measure. And even though something may make us afraid, you know, that curiosity seems to go and trump that. You know, the moth to the flame, the rat to the cheese, the spider watching the fly. I mean, it's all part of who we are and what we do. We conquer those fears through this journey, through this quest. And Bigfoot sort of represents that. Bigfoot is the unknown, but not a terrifying unknown, because, you know, when you listen to some of the legends from the coastal tribes in British Columbia and places in Canada, an honor. It was a sacred thing to actually view Bigfoot. Bigfoot was the preserver of the environment, the protector of the environment. So all of the things about Bigfoot are good, not terrifying. And also the other thing too, Paul, let me say this. In all of the reports, except for two, in all of the accounts of Bigfoot and Sasquatch, none of them show that Bigfoot is aggressive. Most of the accounts show that Bigfoot is sort of a curious creature, a reclusive creature that may see us and then goes away, but does not attack, is not ferocious. They're very predictable and they're very boring. And there was an article in the New York Times, I believe it was, and about the quest for the hunt for Bigfoot, and what the journalist said was, these reports are boring because nothing happens other than you see this creature that's either 8 or 12 or 16 foot tall, and they look at you, you look at them, and then they go away. It's just a fleeting thing, and then they're gone. The two episodes were episodes of violence. The one was in the Stone Canyon, Ape Canyon, where the men in the cabin were attacked by these Bigfoot creatures. The other one, President Theodore Roosevelt,
yes,
our American president, wrote about a Bigfoot-like creature in Montana that killed a hunter. Mm-hmm. Now, those are the only accounts. Again, if there's more, please tell me, but I don't know of any. So it's not that Bigfoot is a ferocious creature. My contribution to this thing is it's kind of interesting. My wife and I are what they call snowbirds. Yeah. We spend winters in Florida, and we spend summers in Pennsylvania. So in all of the information that I see, and there's not one common group that keeps data on this. Okay, we don't have an FBI or KGB file on Bigfoot. But yes, from what I've been reading, Bigfoot is most prevalent in Washington State in the United States, in California, and in either Florida or Pennsylvania. Mm. Now, in Florida, we have the skunk ape.
Yep.
And there's plenty of places for the skunk ape to hide. You know, the Everglades, a 16 county area from Miami, Wade up to Polk County. There's plenty of places. There's plenty of swamps and forests where this creature could hide. And in Pennsylvania, in western Pennsylvania, there's a place called Chestnut Ridge. Chestnut Ridge sees an abundance of Bigfoot and orbs or flying saucers. Now, listen, when I first heard this, I thought, nonsense. This makes no sense at all. Bigfoot and flying saucers. This is totally weird, totally ridiculous. But when you read the accounts, and we have back home, we're fortunate enough to have a guy named Stan Gordon.
Yes.
Stan Gordon is the guy that is the keeper of the key. He has the key to the kingdom. Whenever people call the Pennsylvania State Police in Western Pennsylvania and say, I've seen a flying saucer or I've seen a Bigfoot, they say, call Stan Gordon. Here's his number. So Stan documents all this stuff. And what's incredible, and I mean really incredible, is that Stan has countless, he has numerous accounts of people seeing a Bigfoot creature emerging from an orb or a flying saucer landing and taking Bigfoot creatures aboard. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know what, the only thing that means to me when you put, I guess when you try to put two and two together, is that there's a psychic, there's a supernatural element to both Bigfoot and flying saucers. There's something at play here. We don't know what it is, but it's outside of the realm of science. It may be part of science, and maybe someday you and I and our scientific brothers will figure it out. But right now, it's out there. We don't have a rhyme or reason. We don't have cause and effect. So it may be part of the scientific realm and scientific thought. But right now, we don't know what it is. So again, it's supernatural. It's out there. It's beyond science. So that's what it is. And we're all looking. We all want to find it. We're, you know, and that's what I did with, if I may, the Lost Tribes of Bigfoot. I just wanted to go and look at the research, look at the documentation, and put it all together and try to figure it out. So that was what I wanted to be my contribution. I'll say this, and listen, I know some of your listeners are going to think I'm blowing my own horn, but let me do this. I take pride in being an author and a researcher. I believe that my books, and this book in particular, is well-researched and well-written. And again, I take pride in that. I know that there's countless books out there about Bigfoot that I've read from people that are out in the woods looking that just embarrass me, and I think embarrass our paranormal community with their just very pedestrian attempts at putting a book together. And again, that's, you know, I mean, I'm just saying that anybody could write a book, and that's fine to contribute to the narrative. But if you're going to do it, let's do it in a way that honors our craft and our profession. Let's do it in a way that when a scientist can pick up the book, they could say, yes, this makes sense. I may not agree with it, but it makes sense. So all we're trying to do is to put out a hypothesis, a philosophy out there that other people could take a look at and say yes or no. And that's what I try to do. And again, I take pride in having a product, a book that is palatable. I mean, you can read it and taste it and understand it. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a good book. So I am surrounded by people. I mean, I get books all the time. We go to these expos, we trade books, and some of the things that I get, I just can't believe what's being put out there. You know, I mean, and really with typos and just with not connecting A to B. So that's my personal peeve. You know, I mean, all I want to do is I want to go and do the, be the best voice for the paranormal community. I want to approach this as an academic and a scientist, and I want to make a difference. I want to make a difference in the craft. So if I can elevate the conversation, you know, through my words and through my writing, then that's, I think, what I want to do.
As I said in the introduction, Maxim, you're a man of many interests, as we discussed on your first appearance a few months ago.
Yeah.
Bigfoot, how did it draw you in then? Were you one of those people that saw the Patterson film and that was it? Or was it you came across these things? Because, I mean, obviously, one of the other aspects of your life is you're a Vietnam vet, Maxim.
Yeah, exactly.
There are stories about rock apes from Vietnam that GIs encountered, which have kind of almost gone into a kind of legendary status, though there are stories from that part of Asia of hairy beasts living in the woods. Yeah. So it's not like the GIs just invented it to build on Bigfoot.
I'm familiar with some of that, and I had been researching some of that. But it's, I think, way back when The Abominable Snowman came out, and that was the British film with, I believe, Peter Cushing.
Yes.
And that was pretty terrifying. I mean, they did Abominable Snowman right. Mm. So I think that might have been around 58, 59. So we started to hear about the Abominable Snowman, mainly in colleges. You know, the college kids, high school kids would go in to see this thing and talk about it. So it was really well done. It was terrifying, and it made an impact. In 1958, the red letter date was 1958, when the Humboldt Times had an article about the California Abominable Snowman, and they used the word Bigfoot. This was the first time that the word Bigfoot, I believe, entered our lexicon and was in print. What happened when they wrote this article? They had thousands of letters. Thousands of people responded saying, yes, I believe that the California Abominable Snowman exists, or yes, I have seen this creature. So not only that, I mean, they touched a nerve, they pushed a button, but this thing hit the wire services and kaboom, it went around the world, and the Associated Press and Copley and everybody else picked it up and reprinted it with their own slant, and Bigfoot took off. It started in 1958. Now, if we're keeping tabs, 1958, you know, like a Miller analogy test, 1958 is to Bigfoot as 1947 is to flying saucers.
Yes.
You know, Kenneth Arnold saw the nine disc at Mount Rainier in 1947, and then we had Roswell, I think maybe a month later. So in 1947, that's when everybody started to see these saucers. It was almost like a Rorschach test. And the same thing, I believe, with Bigfoot. Bigfoot has never gone away with the computers, with motion pictures, especially the folk monster from Arkansas. And that was the big one. There was a documentary done that did well in Arkansas and Louisiana. And they realized that this thing had legs, you know, Hollywood terminology, it had legs. So they got a distributor, and he distributed the folk monster, you know, throughout the United States. It made millions. I mean, it showed people that there's money to be made in Bigfoot / skunk ape documentaries. And then the floodgates were open. More people started to do that. And Paul, I guess it's the same in the UK as it is over here. Some 19-year-old kid with an iPhone can make a motion picture. The technology's there.
Yes.
You know, you don't need a, you know, $500,000 camera. You could do it with a $1,000 or $1,200 iPhone, whatever they cost. I don't know. But, you know, so the technology's there. And we're finding that there's more and more, that's being added to this whole Bigfoot narrative. The AI concerns me because a lot of that is just bogus and false. And there's a lot of bad actors out there that are claiming things they shouldn't be claiming.
Yep.
But, you know, before we went on, you talked about the Patterson-Gimlin film. And listen, cut me off if you think I'm babbling too much, because I realize that I'm like, I need to come up for air and give you a chance to interject. But, you know, when you ask for information. Again, the 1967 Patterson-Gimlin film is our holy grail. I mean, I don't think there's been anything after that, anything sent before that, that has that kind of validity. And it was only a 58-second tape. And what it was that Patterson and Gimlin were trying to make a documentary about Bigfoot, and with the money from the documentary, they were going to go and put together an expedition to look for Bigfoot. So that was the reason behind this thing. So this is 1967. Mm-hmm. They were going around the bend, and all of a sudden they saw Bigfoot. And Patterson, who was on the lead horse, reached into his saddlebag to get the camera. And he's falling, he's shooting and falling to the ground as he's shooting this thing. Gimlin was behind him, and he was leading a pack horse, so both of those horses bolted, and he was falling off. The female Bigfoot, they named her Patty, she looked at Patterson, and then she turned around and walked away. And that film has been scrutinized, has been digitized, it's been slowed down, they've done everything to it. It's probably been as scrutinized as has been the Zapruder film that looked at the assassination of President John Kennedy in 63. So this thing, the interesting thing about it, we had people that believe that this is true. Now, the people that were disbelievers, and this is interesting, they said that, well, it's a man in an ape suit. But when you look at this suit, you can't see zippers or seams. It looks, you could see the glute muscles. You could see the muscularity. So it's either the most incredible body suit that they've ever made, and pretty much advanced beyond their times for 67. Mm-hmm. Or it's the real thing. Now, one thing we have to take note of is the British paleontologist John Napier.
Yes.
John Napier, and again, one of the legends, one of the heroes of our paranormal community, our cryptozoological community. Napier was in charge of the Smithsonian, and in 1972, remember the Patterson-Gimlin film was 1967. So in 1967,
five years
later, he got a copy of the Patterson-Gimlin film. Napier took a look at it and he said that it was a hoax. And the reason he said it was a hoax was because the upper part of Patty was like an ape. Mm-hmm. And the bottom part was like a hominid. It was bipedal. It walked. He said that Patterson-Gimlin just simply cobbled together aspects of an ape and a man. So that was his rationale. That was in 1972. In 1974, over in Ethiopia, these guy researchers discovered Lucy. Now, Lucy was named after the Beatles, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. And you Brits, man, you're all over this. You had all these contributions. So they see this. It was Australopithecus, and it was man's earliest relative. It was only like 3.5, maybe 4 foot tall. But anyway, they found this thing that they called Lucy. That night, they got drunk and they listened to the Beatles, and it made history. But that was in 74. John Napier, who in 1972 said that it was a hoax, when he looked at it, he said, wait a second, let's take a look at this, because Lucy, Australopithecus, had an upper body like an ape, you know, the swing through the trees and all that, the muscularity, mm-hmm. and the bottom like a hominid. She walked on 2 feet like a human. Yeah. Napier said, I was wrong. And here's an example of science coming through. I mean, finally, we got scientific proof that helps validate some of the theories that we had, in this case, in cryptozoology. So John Napier became a very big fan of the Patterson-Gimlin film. But it was just a really good debate. It was a good time to take a look at that. And when he looked at it at the Smithsonian, he had a number of Russian scientists with him who were very much believed in this film and believed in Yeti and Almas and the Abominable Snowman, more so than their American counterparts. Yes. So this was kind of interesting how science came full circle and, you know, just a pretty interesting, you know, way for this to play out.
Mm-hmm. As you say, I think it is... certainly in the world of weirdness, Maxim, I think it's probably one of, if not the most viewed clip of any phenomena ever, I think, that anybody's captured, be that in ufology, in hauntings, in cryptozoology. That film probably is the one that most people are aware of. For me, it's amazing that we're still having these kind of disagreements. I mean, I'm the same as you. I know enough about movies in the 60s and special effects. I know how much the budget for Planet of the Apes was that came out the year after. It was actually being filmed in 1967. They spent near enough $250,000 in 1967 to do the makeup that basically looks like men wearing monkey masks.
Yeah.
And if you look at Patty, the special effects work would have to be something akin to what they could probably do now. And I've always said, if you want me to believe it's a hoax, I want you to recreate it using things that were available in 1967. Animal Planet tried that, and it was horrendous. It looked like a really crappy suit. And they didn't use things that were available in 1967. They used things that were available now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's always baffles me that people go, oh, well, it's clearly a man in a suit. Which, the morphology of it, the stride, the length of the arms, the way that the fingers move, that is beyond any realm of comprehension of anybody doing, you know. And I've seen very famous special effects artists go, oh yeah, it was a fake. One of them, the first film he worked on, he had a budget of $70,000. It's one of the worst things. It's called Octoman. And essentially, it looks like a man wearing an octopus suit, which he is. Mm-hmm. And it's dreadful, Maxim.
Yeah.
But he's saying, oh, well, I know it's clearly a fake. And then 8 years later, with $70,000, he makes something atrocious. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to say he doesn't make incredible things now, because he's got the budget to work with.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I've always found puzzling about this. I know you mentioned The Abominable Snowman, the Hammer film that came out, which is probably one of the most overlooked Hammer films. I absolutely love that film myself as well.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, it's awesome.
Because it's quite weird and it's quite mystical in regards to it, what's going on. And Peter Cushing's playing the steadfast British scientist as always. And you've got Americans just running about shooting things that always leads to trouble. Maxim, yep. That kind of post-war grit and intelligence coming together to try and solve a mystery.
Yeah.
And that's quite a different take on it all, because it's not really the thing you see. But whenever anybody talks about Bigfoot, or whenever you see a documentary, they always use the Patterson film, always. And I mean, strangely enough, I was doing another interview recently. We were talking about there are other clips of other incidents out there that just never get used. And whether that's because it's not as clear or it's not as on the pedestal as that particular footage, I'm not sure. I think sometimes the Patterson film is its own worst enemy, because it's been seen so much now. And like you've said, it's been analysed, it's been reanalysed, it's been 4K restored, it's had AI used on it, it's been decluttered, cleaned up, expanded. Yeah. They've done everything. They've run it backwards, they've run it forwards.
Yeah.
I've seen it in numerous versions. I'm still where I am all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a challenge because I love science and I love mystery. So there are days sometimes, Maxim, I wake up and I think, why on earth? Why am I? I've always got me 1%, Maxim. Why do I believe this? Wherever it is around the world, why do I believe this? And then I begin to think about how many witnesses we've got, how far back it goes. The fact that, as you say, the vast majority of encounters are very sort of bland. I know, as you mentioned, that article written in the 70s in the New York Times, it's the blandness of the encounter that makes people think it must be real, because it's not, you know, swinging from the trees or throwing
it's
a tree at
dramatic.
People.
It's not dramatic. It's not Hollywood. It's just
doing like normal creatures do, as you would expect.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes when you start to then go past these points and start looking at how it is now, when you've got so many strands, as you sort of alluded to earlier, it becomes very difficult then, because there are big gaps in it, that you've got people in certain camps who have made they have decided it's this.
Yeah.
And they don't believe that. And you're thinking, well, hang on a minute, we're talking about the same phenomena, and there seems to be about four different camps that are coming at it. I suppose for you, was that surprising to see that you've got people who think it's interdimensional, that it's an alien, that it's actually a species of human that has chosen to remove itself from modernity and keep out of our way because we usually just cause trouble, or it's a lost ape species that we've just not caught?
Yeah. Well, I like the fact that we're talking about all of this. You know, and we should. And, you know, you talk about all the different theories, and then at the end of the day, let's take a look at the ones that make the most sense and hang our hat on that. I mean, that's what we need to do. So by having this conversation, this discussion, I mean, that's what I think this is all about. I think that the human psyche has to make sense of things. We need balance and what they call homeostasis.
Yes.
If there's a gap in things, we confabulate, we make things up. If we go through a blackout or a gray out, you know, we go and put something in there. I mean, we can't exist without that vacuum. So we're, you know, the human mind, we are different than apes, different than animals, just because we have more synapses. Mm. In this case, more is better. The reason that we are who we are, the reason that we have cognitive abilities, and I believe spiritual abilities, and maybe even psychic abilities, is because of all of the DNA, all of the things that we have in abundance that the other apes don't have. And yes, even though we share 98% of our DNA with chimpanzees and gorillas and bonobos, still that 2% is what gives us the edge. Again, more is better.
Yes.
We think more clearly. We can think abstractly. And it's not just about tools, and it's not just about burying the dead like the Neanderthals did. And it's not just about making art, but climbing higher and higher. And I mean, God bless humanity and human beings. We are an awesome species. And young people out there, if you're listening to me, don't desecrate the temple. I mean, come on, keep it going. I mean, do everything you can to keep your cognition going. Do everything in moderation and just honor the temple because we have a gift. I want to say that with the Patterson-Gimlin film, I always consider that our gift, a gift to our community, to the believers. We have so little else. What we have is castigation. We have us being looked at as weirdos and kooks for believing. But the Patterson-Gimlin film, you could show it to anybody, and there's room for discussion. I mean, this is in a sense, our holy grail. So it's better than anything I've seen. I've seen in my book, The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot, I talk about the 2023 Colorado train video. And yes. these kids are on their honeymoon, and they're on a train, and they see this Bigfoot down there, and somebody takes a picture of it. But it was just very suspect. And, the other one was the Freeman video from, I think, the 90s. Yes. That, again, it looks good, but it just doesn't have the clout. It doesn't resonate as does Patterson-Gimlin. And, and that's a story in itself, because when Patterson and Gimlin announced this thing, Patterson did everything he could to make a couple of bucks and to promote it. Not Bob Gimlin. Bob Gimlin was off the grid. He took off. He was just riding his horse all around the wilderness until he was tracked down. He's like 87 now, and brought into some of these Bigfoot conferences where he is viewed as a godlike figure. I mean, yes. He is the guy that saw Bigfoot. He's the guy that was there. I mean, Bob Gimlin, and just amazing, amazing how that played out. So I don't know. I mean, I would like to. I've tried many times to go and interview Bob Gimlin. I'd love to be in a room with him and just to talk to him, just to be in his presence. And hopefully that could happen at some point. So,
absolutely.
Maybe you could get him on your program. The three of us could talk to him.
Yeah, I've been trying for a long time. Don't you worry about that, Maxie. I mean, it is fascinating. Obviously, you've kind of met some of the great and the good. I mean, Dr. Jeff Meldrum's been on here a couple of times. Yeah. Who for me, is, as you mentioned, in regards to Gimlin, I think when you look at it coming from the scientific side, he's certainly up there, as was Grover Krantz, was John Bindenengel.
Okay.
You know, these are learned men. These are people who have a background in science. They are doctors in their particular field. Yeah. They are not somebody from Newark claiming that they know all the answers. You know what I mean? With the great respect and no disrespect to anybody in Newark who's into Bigfoot.
I don't know. I think you're going to piss off a lot of people from New Jersey.
It doesn't take much.
That's how I take it.
It doesn't take much from what I've heard, Maxim. But it's fascinating that you've got these people who clearly, and like you say, you look at the Russians had a department looking into it. The Chinese have still.
Yeah.
There's clearly one of these, this aspect that it's a mystery. And like you were saying about how when we discovered Lucy, you look at the stories of little hairy people that were always dismissed until we discovered Homo floresiensis in the Pacific 20 years ago. And so we now know that there were populations of small hairy people, Flores Island.
Yeah.
We don't know that much about apes and that kind of lineage because, with the greatest respect, we've only really been interested in it for about 150 years. So we know next to nothing. And so we keep seeing all these things that have changed that 50 years ago, Neanderthals were wiped out and they were all stupid and idiots and we were far cleverer. That's not true anymore. We know that didn't happen.
And we're finding that out every day. Just recently they discovered artwork by Neanderthals. I mean, they buried their dead. They had rituals. They had family communities.
Yeah.
And we know this because they pretty much lived in sandstone caves. And when they died, their bodies were preserved. So the sandstone seemed to do a pretty good job. And so we have a really good fossil record looking at the Neanderthal. But you're correct. They were advanced. They weren't, animals. They were more human-like. I mean, they were part of our ancestors. And many of us have Neanderthal DNA because Homo erectus and Homo sapiens interbred with Neanderthal. So as many as 40% of the population has maybe 3 to 4% Neanderthal DNA. So that's that. You mentioned Grover Krantz as being one of the people that contributed to the Bigfoot thing. Grover Krantz was noted for being the first one to officially use the word Sasquatch.
Yeah,
which was interesting because we're talking about Abominable Snowman and Almas and Yeti and all the stuff from Tibet and the Himalayas. And then we started to talk about Bigfoot, but actually Bigfoot came later. It was Sasquatch from British Columbia, and Grover Krantz was the one who talked about that. So that was pretty interesting, too, because when we started to find out more about Bigfoot, we realized, wait a second, this didn't just start in 1958. This has been around for thousands of years as per the record of coastal peoples there in Canada and British Columbia with the totem poles and the stories and everything else. So they knew of this creature that they believed could shapeshift, could change, could materialize into rocks and trees and everything, that it was a supernatural being that has had these abilities. So that paranormal aspect of Sasquatch is that theory that Sasquatch has paranormal abilities is nothing new. It's been around for thousands of years. And when people like Rosemary Guiley said that it has rapid transport or bilocation, where you see it in front of you and then you see it behind you, you know, and go try to figure that out. But that is just part of the paranormal aspect of Sasquatch that I believe that's what makes it so hard to track it down and find it. Because I believe my theory is that it's an interdimensional creature, that it shapeshifts between dimensions. And I believe that flying saucers, UFOs, UAPs, call them what you will, do the same thing, that the space-time continuum, you know, you could fold it, you could put a hole in it, a wormhole or a bridge, and theoretically you could go pass from that space-time continuum from one parallel universe to another. And that theory, it's just a theory, it hasn't been proven yet, but that makes sense. So it's just a matter of us doing the homework. I mean, not us, not me and you, Paul, but the scientists. I mean, I don't know. That's beyond my pay grade. It's amazing how guys like you and I, well, maybe more like me, you know, because I'm just a novice. I'm trying to figure this out, but I don't have any kind of a degree in astrophysics or biology or all that stuff, or mathematics, where maybe if I did, I would be able to see this clearer. You know, I don't know. But again, in a sense, I think a lot of it, we're just amateurs trying to figure it out, trying to find the right words and phrases and the right definitions, you know, to come up with to make this more understandable. And let me say this as well, that if I may. And you're saying what? Stop, you've said enough, right? I can read your mind. I think that we need to do that. I think we need to keep on discussing it, to give it parameters, to give it a definition, to when Freud and Jung devised their talk therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, they said if you could talk about something, you could give it a beginning and end, a top and a bottom. You could go and identify it and realize that this horrific thing that you're dealing with, if this is it,
yeah,
you know, it doesn't have to be this monster that smothers you, this omnivore, but it could be something that has a beginning and end, something that you can identify and put into a little file, a little box, and control and contained. Mm-hmm. And that's that talk therapy is what I think we do, or at least what I think I try to do with the paranormal. Give it boundaries, give it a definition, you know, identify those parameters and, you know, try to define what it is and all that. So that's the best we can do, unless you're an eyewitness to these things and, you know, and you have some, you know, some first person intel to share. You know, very few people do. And as far as the Bigfoot thing, I know people that tell me they talk to Bigfoot, Yes. They claim that Bigfoot is their teacher and they're the students. They tell me that Bigfoot gives them gifts. They tell me that Bigfoot likes apples, that Bigfoot likes soft music, that Bigfoot doesn't like rap or hip hop. So that's what they tell me. Now, you know, all I can do is say, okay, I mean, you know, I've never met Bigfoot, but, you know, I've been told too that with my interest in Bigfoot, and I've been told that maybe Bigfoot is working through me. Maybe Bigfoot is using me as a conduit to get this information out. And again, I don't know. But I mean, I was told this, but, you know, I mean, who knows, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. To be fair, there aren't many things I've not heard Bigfoot can do, depending. Because this is the thing, I think. You kind of come into this thinking we're talking about lost apes. And then you can get, especially this day and age, Maxim, there are so many different strands that you can pull on, like you say. I mean, I often consider the trans-dimensional aspect to it, where I often consider, where we talk about the theoretical possibly of alternative realities. And maybe somewhere out there, I know Michio Kaku has talked about the fact that you would have parallel dimensions running alongside each other, and so you're sitting in your room in your dimension, but somewhere else there's a dinosaur walking through it, or a Victorian housekeeper still lives there, or a tribe of hairy hominids are just walking through because that's what they're doing in their particular dimension. And so with some of the aspects, you could put up, if you wanted to go into that kind of trans-dimensional theoretical aspect of it, you could suggest that occasionally these things overlap, as you refer to in regards to, say, UFOs and things. And that. And so Keel opened the box on that kind of ultra-terrestrial, and that kind of changed the direction of how people looked in regards to certain UFO cases. But when it comes to this, I think you've got so many people. I mean, I've spoken to Ron Moorhead, who's a big believer in the sort of quantum aspect of Bigfoot. I spoke to Dr. Jeff Meldrum, who was obviously, he's all in flesh and blood.
Yep.
The one gap I've always seen in all these people's theories is that nobody believes it could be the ghost of something, Maxim. People think it's an alien traveller. It's a spirit creature or something, not necessarily a ghost, as we would consider it. But I often think where sometimes people see something and it just disappears. If that was a person in the woods, they'd think they'd seen a ghost. But because it's Bigfoot, they think, oh, well, it must be going through a different portal or something. And none of them, regardless of which side they come at it, whether they're flesh and blood or the transdimensional camp, neither of them want to talk about ghosts. They both dance around that aspect of it. And so I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all some situations. I think maybe some of them go on because, like, as you mentioned earlier on, Chestnut Ridge with Stan's work there and all the stuff that happened in the 70s and some of the accounts, just they don't make sense if we're talking about, you know, people claiming to have shot them in the face with a shotgun and nothing happened.
Yeah, yeah.
People seeing them running towards UFOs that have landed. And then you compare them to, say, some of the things that go on in Florida and some of the footage that's been caught on camera there, where they just seem to be acting like animals do. They're just running about. It's fascinating for me that I think you've got so many different parts to this that you can't as outlandish as they may seem to you at first. And I would imagine this was quite the introduction for it for you doing this book as well, Maxim, that there are aspects of each particular camp that you can pull on, think, I think there's more to this. I don't think I'm not all in. But I certainly think there's more to chew on here than just, because that's the problem often. If somebody comes with an idea that's the complete opposite of what you believe, that your normal reaction is just to dismiss it out of hand and say that's nonsense.
Yeah. I had a book published called Coal Region Hoodoo.
Mm.
And I believe we discussed it. That came out in 2023. That was Beyond the Fray Press. Mm-hmm. And I had two chapters on Bigfoot. One was the Bigfoot enigma, and the other was the Bigfoot hypothesis.
Yeah.
And I thought that maybe in these two chapters, I could go and nail it. I could figure it out. And I didn't. I mean, it was just impossible to do that. So the Lost Tribes of Bigfoot, you know, came out of that. I mean, I had this driving need to go and figure it out and put it down. And I spent a lot of time researching Sasquatch and Yeti and the Abominable Snowman and trying to make sense of it, what it was. as well as call out the hoaxers.
Yeah.
And I claim that the hoaxers have sold their souls to the devil for their 30 pieces of silver and for their 15 minutes of fame. Horrible stuff what these people do just to get some notoriety, you know, what they do to our community. Yeah. And I think it's wrong. And I talk about the Minnesota Iceman,
yes,
took place here in the States. And I talk about the Piltdown Man disgrace that took place in the UK.
Yes.
In both cases, they were hoaxes. And in the case of the Piltdown Man, it wasn't so much about, you know, well, the Charles Dawson wanted the notoriety, but also there was nationalistic pride because Germany had the Heidelberg Man.
Yes.
And so if the UK could have their Piltdown Man, you could have something that was older and you could have the bragging rights for that. Mm-hmm. And so for maybe a 40-year period, a lot of politicians and scientists in the UK looked the other way, maybe hoping that, you know, that this Piltdown Man would be accepted and everything, but it wasn't. What happened was Dawson found some skeletons that were really old. They were thousands of years old, but he took the skull of a human and the jaw of an orangutan. He peppered it with iron oxide. He made everything look old. He filed down the teeth of the orangutan to make it look more humanoid.
Yeah.
And so it was all a very big scam. And when it went down, I mean, a lot of people went down with it, but a lot of people wanted that to be true. And mm-hmm. and even with the Minnesota Iceman, we had some leading cryptozoologists like Bernard Helvemans,
yeah,
who believed that it was true. They got duped. They got hoodwinked. They got sucker punched. They got bamboozled. I mean, it was just, you know, it was just a hoax, and they got conned. So anyway, but in my in Lost Hearts of Bigfoot, I talk about the hoaxers and why they do this and why it's wrong. Mm. And I've gone on record stating that I think it's wrong. And I've gotten a little militant about it, but it is wrong. I mean, why lie when you can tell the truth? Why yeah. lie when the truth can serve you? You know, so.
Yeah, absolutely. It is deeply frustrating, I have to say. I would say the vast majority of things I see clips online these days, Maxim, I would say 99.9% of them are fake or hoax.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
there are certain characters around these days, as soon as I see their name attached to anything, I instantly dismiss it because I know their reputation, I know what they do.
Yeah.
And yet for every kind of person like that, you'll get people who really surprise you when they decide to come and join this field. Les Stroud is a prime example of that, you know, a well-known probably around the world as a survivor man. He goes into extreme locations and lives off the land. He had something weird happen to him. It's changed him overnight. He's I wouldn't say he's obsessed, but he thinks there's strange things out there and he doesn't know what's going on. Now, he's got some criticism because he's aligned himself with someone who a lot of people think is a hoaxer. However, that's clearly not tarnishing Les's appetite for this particular subject. And I think even in this day and age, when you've got a naturalist as well known and as well versed going into really strange and dangerous terrain as somebody like Les Stroud, for him to suddenly get into this at his age, I think just shows that there are certain things that can happen to people in far-flung places that really shake them, because to all intents and purposes, they seem to be experiencing something that shouldn't exist.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And again, I think that we have a need to figure it out. We have, we love a puzzle. Mm-hmm. You know, we love, I mean, courtroom dramas. Every single courtroom drama is something. And a CSI show, I mean, they are just so big. They, the Conjuring franchise, which is of interest because it's not Bigfoot, but Conjuring the Last Rites takes place here in northeastern Pennsylvania, my backyard. It was the Schmurl haunting.
Yes.
And that was the last exorcism, I believe, that Ed and Lorraine Warren performed. And mm-hmm. I met them when they were on tour. They co-wrote the book, The Haunted. And I met them when they were on the book tour and became friends with them over the years. So, but that's, you know, whether it's cryptozoology or ufology or demonology, it's all the same. And whether it's spiritual, paranormal, or scientific, it's all the same. Everything is the same. It's this big ball of ectoplasmic goo that just blends into each other. And again, we try to go and, you know, distill it and explain it and break it down into the variables and the common denominators and all that. And it's just, I mean, it's a marvelous experience. It's a wonderful thing to do. It's a lot of conjecture and a lot of what do you think about this, you know, a lot of personal stuff. But I'll tell you what, Paul, on my journey, and I have no idea what the destination is, but on my journey, I've met so many wonderful and exciting, interesting people as yourself that it makes it worthwhile. And I'm just enjoying being part of the paranormal realm. And hopefully, I mean, my big hope, my wish is that in some way I could make a contribution to the field, you know, in some little way, just to maybe offer a definition or a word or an explanation. So again, that's if that happens, then so be it. You know, then I'm happy and satisfied, you know. So
yeah, I suppose it's interesting as well when you set out in an endeavor like this, Maxim, with an interest in the particular subject, to come out the other end and still be as passionate about it, to be as interested in it. Because sometimes when you dive into subjects that you love, I would imagine that sometimes it can be tarnished a little when you, as you say, when you have to deal with it. Because it's the world of cryptozoology is a bit of a swamp, to say the very least. There does seem to be a bit of a sea change over the last few years. And obviously doing this show, I've met people I could never have imagined I would speak to from all over the US, from Washington State and Oregon down to people from Texas and Florida. I just find it incredible that you've got this fascination with people and it's the way it's enabling people to, who perhaps would never have got into biology or science, Maxim, that, you know, they could be some guy who works in a garage. They could be some woman who works in a beautician's. But for some reason, Bigfoot has seemed to have changed their life for the positive. And you find these people who've suddenly become, they've learnt all about the forests and nature and become qualified and knowing about how the biology of certain topographical locations in the States is different and getting a level of intelligence that they probably wouldn't have wanted or pushed themselves to gain if it wasn't for this love of looking for a giant hairy creature running about North America, Maxim. It changes people's lives and often for the better.
It's not folly. It's something. There's something here. We don't know what it is, but there's something here. And that's why we're looking. I participate in the Ocala Bigfoot Expo. They have it down in Ocala, Florida. It's huge. It's big. And I can't believe the people I have met, the doors that have opened. I mean, what a wonderful community. And thousands and thousands and thousands of people, you know, and just amazing. I mean, it's amazing when, you know, people walk up to me and say, hey, I heard you on a certain podcast. You know, but it's kind of, when that happens, you know, that's kind of really kind of neat. But it's very fulfilling and satisfying. And, you know, again, I hope that if people have any interest that they might consider picking up a copy of The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot. And also, Paul, let me just say this, if I could. In the book, there's a thing called IBT. It's immersive book technology.
Yes.
And if you take your phone's camera and hit that, you'll open up a video of me doing a synopsis of various chapters. Mm. So it's a relatively new, I mean, it's old technology, but they've repurposed it. They've retrofitted it and made it work. And I'm just so glad that that my book has that. You know, that was Hangar One's idea, but it's really sort of like an interactive way of, you know, reading the book and, you know, talk and communicating with the author. So it's kind of just a wonderful experience and, you know, a nice little technological advance.
Absolutely. Well, I wouldn't be surprised if Doug was pushing the envelope about how to make books more exciting, knowing the way Doug's mind works.
He's a great guy. Hangar One treats me pretty good. I like Hangar One Publishers and everything they've done. So Doug and Alex Hychek, great people.
Yeah. I know, as you said earlier, with you being a snowbird, I mean, Florida is renowned for the skunk ape. If you know anything about cryptids, Maxim. Florida's one of the hotspots. I mean, I've got to know Dave Sheely. Who's essentially, I think some people would say he's Mr. Skunk Ape. Not physically, certain cases have certain researchers or investigators. I mean, some of the footage Dave's caught, I mean, I've seen people try to recreate it. They can't fake it. Yeah. And so you would have to say it's either great circumstance or that's very compelling footage. But obviously there is other strange footage of things running across roads in Florida. And I think, as with a lot of places in the States, people think of Florida, they think of theme parks and beaches, Maxim. They don't understand the Everglades at all or how big it is. And, you know, if there's I think the last estimate was that they reckon there's at least 3 million giant pythons living in the Everglades. If they can hide there the greatest respect and hardly be seen, because, you know, I know they do the snake hunting and stuff, but they don't get anywhere near, you know, they're not bringing thousands out.
Yeah.
Then there's clearly something there. And you see these certain places like Texas. Everybody thinks Texas is all oil fields and big cities. But the whole eastern side of Texas is a lush, green, big thicket. Yeah. And you get reports all across there. Is it tempting? Obviously, I would imagine you've already tried your hand at going out looking for the skunk ape. I suppose it makes it more fascinating that whilst you have it where you are in Pennsylvania, up on Chestnut Ridge is another hotspot.
Yeah.
And Skunk Ape is clearly what people would consider is your flesh and blood version, because there doesn't seem to be any magical elements prescribed to it. It seems to be, once again, as we said, very bland in its reactions. It's wandering around. It's running across a field. There doesn't seem to be anything else going on.
Yeah. The only other thing that I would bring up is the Mayakaka ape. And that was down in Sarasota.
Yes.
There was an elderly couple that had a camera, and they caught this creature that looked like an orangutan. So that's all over the internet. You could see that. And Lauren Coleman, the famous cryptozoologist from Portland, Maine, I believe, looked at it and said either it is an escaped orangutan or it is an orangutan-like creature that's out there. But, I mean, that's what it looked like. And, of course, we know that Gigantopithecus was the largest ape that ever walked the earth, and maybe something like 14 foot tall. And Giganto looked like an orangutan, like a humongous orangutan. Yeah. But, of course, with Gigantopithecus, the problem with that ape species is that they were too big. Mm. And when climate change came millions of years ago, and climate change comes and goes, maybe it's coming more often now, but when it comes, with Gigantopithecus, all of the fruit, the good stuff was up in the trees, and Giganto was too big to climb the tree. So Giganto could only eat acorns and leaves and branches and eventually died off because it couldn't get the nutritional fruits and things, nuts that were higher. So that was what happened with that creature. But again, Gigantopithecus, Mayakaka ape, you know, orangutan, there's some kind of commonality there, you know, variables. I mean, we tried to figure out what that was, but Lauren Coleman believed that there's something there. There was something there. And where I live in Citrus County, Florida, we're close to the Green Swamp and we're close to so many counties, Sumter County and Lake County, where there's swamps. I mean, 110,000 acres of swamp. I mean, plenty of places for things to hide.
Yeah.
People don't go into there because it's dangerous. So, you know, so I mean, I believe that it's possible for undiscovered species to be out there, even in civilization, you know, hiding from us and, or maybe communicating with some of us. I think, you know, one of the theories that I've heard is that some people just have a higher vibration and they're able to communicate with Bigfoot for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. You know, possibly Bigfoot is on a higher level of vibration. Possibly Bigfoot manifests psychic abilities. And they say that Bigfoot has the ability for telepathy and all of this. And so, you know, we don't know. Again, we have theories, we have conjecture, we don't have a body, we don't have DNA.
Yeah.
What we do have is we have the Patterson-Gimlin film, and we have incredibly good evidence with the footprints from Dr. Jeff Meldrum and a lot of other people. Yeah. Footprints that are bigger than any man or bear, strides that are anything that bigger than any man or bear could make. The proof is there, but not the scientific proof that would appease and satisfy the scientific community. So, you know.
You mentioned the Miyake photo. I mean, the thing about that was, I wasn't aware of the full story of that. And the thing that convinced me that that was a real creature is, and not many people are aware of this. I know Lauren was the guy that basically said, prove this.
Yeah.
There are two photos that this lady took of this thing that was coming up and messing up a patio every night.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But a lot of people only see the one picture. And it's not the original, it's a copy of the original picture. But there are two photos. And the second photo is obviously, the first one is the famous flash one where you can see it. And like you say, yeah, clearly looks like
with all the grass like splaying out.
Yeah. Yeah. But the second photo, its pupils have shrunk in reaction to the light. Now, if that's a hoax, how have they done that? So the only way, because I remember, I think I was speaking to Lyle Blackburn, who's an incredible author, brilliant researcher, done a lot of books on certain cryptid cases all around, folk, monster, beast of Boggy Creek, yeah, primarily. He was saying about the fact that that kind of aspect, people just don't want to talk about. And somebody said, oh, well, it was somebody in a monkey suit. And he said, where did they buy this monkey suit from?
Yeah,
you
right,
can't
yeah.
buy an orangutan suit that looks like that. So either somebody made it and decided to wander around Florida patios at 11 p.m.
Yeah.
trying to frighten people, which, to be fair, Florida's not the kind of state I would advise people to be wandering around dressed as a monkey in palm
patios.
People
are locked and loaded. They have guns
yes,
down there.
Yes, precisely. And this is the other thing about hoaxing, Maxim. So, you know, if you're running about in certain locations at certain times of year, you're liable to get your head blown off, never mind anything else.
Yeah.
And so when people talk about that, they just say, oh, well, it's a suit. Well, there is no suit. You can't buy that suit.
Yeah.
And also people see one picture when the second one clearly shows its eyes are shrinking because it's been hit by that bright light. So how's that happened?
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing, too, it was an elderly couple that were sort of embarrassed I believe they sent these pictures into the police department or left it there. It was sort of anonymously. So they didn't want to get involved. But, you know, it seems to be a legitimate thing. And when you take a look at where skunk ape and Mayakaka, all these have been, it's throughout Florida. And again, so many places to hide, so many. The theory that I've heard is that skunk ape is smaller than Bigfoot. It's another variation of it. It's the Florida's variation of it. Also that the high point for skunk ape sightings was in the 1970s, but because of development and every square acre of Florida is being developed by highways and supermarkets and shopping malls and everything else. I mean, it's all concrete. They claim that skunk ape has been driven up to either Georgia or into the Everglades. So that makes sense. But again, with the, you know, we are encroaching on their habitat, and we've been doing that for a long time, and it's really not getting any better. So, it may be that, you know, we start having Bigfoot confrontations, because I think that everything's getting a little bit smaller and closer. And, if it happens, it may happen in our lifetime. You know, we may actually start seeing these creatures.
Yes.
They may have no place to hide.
Well, I suppose that's the fascinating thing, because in the States, especially, and Canada's the same with the provinces, I think Hawaii is the only one that doesn't actually have recorded sightings. They have stories of hairy people, but not to the limit of size of Bigfoot, which are more traditional Hawaii stories from the native cultures there, Maxim. But every other state, the other 49, from California all the way across to, once again, New Jersey, up to Maine.
With that Newark, okay.
Yeah. Every state, Virginia, Kentucky, Alabama, Texas, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, people are seeing these things, but it's not, this is the other aspect, as we mentioned earlier on in the conversation, Bigfoot became popular culture from the 50s onwards. The tribal lore is there that predates it.
Correct.
You've got the first sighting in Canada from Thompson in 1811. You've got thousands of newspaper reports from America and Canada in the 19th century into the early 20th century that all predate television, radio. Yeah.
Yeah. And the big one, too, was Albert Ostman, 1924. Yes. The one and only Bigfoot abduction. Something was messing with his campsite. He decided to hide in a sleeping bag with a rifle. He was going to shoot this culprit. And something picked him up, dumped him in a valley. Here it was a Sasquatch family, father, wife, son, and daughter. And what he did was he was able to tempt the father Sasquatch to try some chewing tobacco. And when the Bigfoot got nauseous, Ostman took off. And then it wasn't until later, this was 1924, it wasn't until later that he contacted John Green, British Columbian journalist, who was one of the original four horsemen of Sasquatchery. So Green took his narrative, and just as you said, Paul, this was before the day and age of computers and microfiche and all this. Albert Ostman didn't have the opportunity to go to Google Bigfoot on his computer and figure this out and be able to articulate it. He lived it. He experienced it. And what he said was several things. He taught us how Bigfoot acted within a family unit. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time we heard about that. A lot of times we just heard about Sasquatch as being a solitary creature. Well, Ostman talked about this family structure. He did not talk about the smell. Typically, when you encounter Bigfoot, it's this horrible rotten egg, wet dog smell. Well, there wasn't anything there. Mm. So we believe, some of us believe, that either that smell is used as a warning, as a defense mechanism, mm-hmm. or if Bigfoot is shape-shifting between dimensions, that it could be that stench, that smell, is a part of the other dimension and that we get a whiff of that as they cross over into our dimension. Again, just a theory, you know, take it or leave it. But we don't know. But Ostman pretty much was the only case I know of a person being abducted by a Sasquatch. That was 1924. And then fast forward to 1961, Betty and Barney Hill get abducted by a flying saucer as they're going through the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And then all of a sudden, here's a cottage industry of everybody saying, yes, I got abducted too, and I've been probed. And then John Mack from Harvard and Whitney Strybner and everybody else jumping up and becoming part of this thing. I mean, alien abductions are just huge. It became CE4. It became another aspect of J. Allen Hynek's Close Encounters of the First, Second, and Third Kind. So it became... Yes. The fourth kind. So, I mean, it's just amazing how this thing played out and how I believe Bigfoot has certain commonality, has certain parallels with flying saucers. And Paul, I love to use the word flying saucers. It just like speaks to me more than UAP. So,
yes, absolutely.
If there's any Pentagon guys listening, well, you know, that's okay. I don't care.
Well, it is. I mean, this is one of the interesting aspects. You know, as we were talking about Napier changing his opinion because of the discovery of Lucy Maxim. Yeah. The smell aspect about that people would always talk about this pungent odour for years in regards to some of the Bigfoot witnesses from the 60s and 70s. And then, what is it, 10 years ago they discovered that gorillas do this. If they're excited or stressed, they have scent glands that emit a pungent, noxious odour mm-hmm. that either warns you away or tells you, I'm frightened here and I don't know what I'm about to do. And so you would think, how would Brian from British Columbia create this kind of aspect of it giving off a scent 40 years before primatologists had discovered this? And that sometimes there are little things in Bigfoot witness accounts that happened 40, 50 years ago that, as I said earlier, because we've only really been studying primates and monkeys and apes for 100, 150 years, Maxim, We still don't know very much. They've got excited recently. You know, we've seen them fishing, you know, using spears to mm-hmm. catch fish, mm-hmm. using tools to bang nuts and berries and get what they mm-hmm. need out of it. We only know what we've done because of the amount of time, and we've probably spent, in the scheme of things, very, very little studying them. And so we only know what we've been able to observe. We haven't got people living there 24/7, 365 days a year. And I think that it's those kind of aspects of reports from the past that really give you pause for thought, because you think, well, you can't have just pulled that from thin air. So clearly that must have happened. But if he's made that up, and then we find out that gorillas can do it 40 years later, mm-hmm. how does that work?
No, I think that when you look at the history, you know, people like Albert Ostman do so much to help with this whole narrative, you know, to go and flesh it out and help define it. I mean, his experience is something that is valid even today, so many years later. As far as the apes, you know, Jane Goodall was one who lived with them and helped to teach them some kind of a language. And I think chimps are as intelligent as a 3-year-old, you know, so they can do things, they can learn things, but we're still in the early stages of that. You know, we talk about the monkeys, but, you know, mammals like whales and dolphins and porpoises are the ones that really have more of it going as far as the cognitive ability, the means of communication and all that. And, you know, we're there's just so much for us to go and learn. And with global warming, with deforestation, with all the things that are happening to the environment, there's a real push out there to identify species before they become extinct. And we're losing a lot of species. But on the other hand, it's almost like a renaissance, because we're finding these species that we haven't seen. Like, I think one of them is the turquoise tarantula. You know, they found this. I mean, things like this, they're very weird. Or even, Paul, if you say that there's nothing new and improved, remember, I think it was January of this year, 2025, in the Arctic, there was a iceberg the size of Chicago that calved. It fell off. And there were a bunch of oceanographers that were maybe an hour away. They saw this. So they went over there, and they had underwater robotic devices. So they sent those devices underneath this glacier that was floating, just to find out what was there. And this glacier had been there for thousands and thousands, maybe millions of years. Mm-hmm. They didn't expect to find anything there, but they found jellyfish that were humongous. They found some of these species that shouldn't be there, that lived there in this blackness, in this darkness, that they weren't quite sure how they survived, because they didn't think that the light was coming down there, or photoplankton, or anything that keeps these organisms alive. So they had to either figure out what that was that kept them alive, or there might have been something else, another source that gave these organisms life that we don't know about. So it was just an exciting thing, but an iceberg the size of Chicago, and they were there at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
And something else too that I think that fascinated me was that some in 2025 they had some of these Martian probes.
Yes.
And we're finding out that there probably was Mars on water on Mars. There were probably canals on Mars, and there were probably civilizations on Mars. Now, we're not talking about yesterday, but we're talking about maybe millions of years ago. So, you know, maybe we can find something, maybe we can learn something. But that, to me, that excites me.
Yeah.
That's part of that quest, part of that Indiana Jones. Like, wow, I wonder what. And I don't know about you, but I'm like this little kid. I remember when I was a kid and I would read every science fiction book that I can, you know, these bug-eyed creatures on another planet. I mean, I was just filled with that. I wanted to learn. And, you know, I mean, what a wonderful thing to be able to go and try to discover that. And not just at a young age, but as a, you know, as in an older age, to be able to retain that passion and excitement and curiosity. That, my friend, is what will keep us young. And I hope that, you know, you maintain your curiosity and passion for as long as I do. So, you know, I'll keep it if you do. How's that?
Certainly. Absolutely. I have to say, I completely agree with you. I can't really explain how excited I was to see the sunrise on Mars. And to think, I just thought to myself, I cannot believe I'm sat here in, I don't know what, 2023 it was, and I'm seeing the sunrise on another planet.
Yeah.
Live. Or we've heard the wind on Mars.
Yeah.
And how that can't fascinate you or fire you up, like you say, to continue that quest for curiosity.
Yeah.
And the human endeavor to solve mystery. It's what keeps us passionate and keeps, like you say, hopefully keeps us young and fresh.
And let me interject too, my friend. If we don't have that passion, then a part of us is dead inside.
Yes.
And so sad. Mm. So sad if a person is going through life without that passion and excitement. Yes. I mean, this is the joy of being alive, to experience that, to discuss it with others, you know, to share that in celebration, all of this. I mean, it's all good. So
absolutely. Well, before I let you leave, Maxim, obviously you're about to launch your latest book, which is, as we touched on last time, The Paranormal Apocalypse. So for anybody who missed our previous conversation, can you give us a brief synopsis of how you see the end of the world coming that will terrify readers later this year?
Well, I don't want to be accused of being a fearmonger, but here's a prototype for Paranormal Apocalypse. Is this how it ends? Mm. And you see, that's the gray dressed as a grim reaper with the sigh and the hourglass and all the death. But basically, it's this. H.P. Lovecraft was the one who said that fear is the most elemental emotion of man, and fear of the unknown is the most powerful.
Mm.
And it works with all of us. We are draped in fear. Fear is being used as a tool by religions, by politicians, by society to keep us afraid. And I take a look at this in my book, Paranormal Apocalypse. I take a look at this fear and what we need to do to contain it. I have a construct called apocalyptic awe, AWE. And apocalyptic awe is being able to turn fear into fascination, to look at that fear through the eyes of art and poetry, of motion pictures and songs and novels. And so we were able to go and take a look at that monster under the bed or the monster in the closet in a way that we could go and contain it, control it, and not let its fear, you know, consume us. So we'll see what happens with the book. But I mean, it's metaphysical, it's spiritual, it's scientific, it's philosophical, it's just a whole lot of things. And I don't know. We believe that it's going to be published in August of 2025, and it's done. It's just being proofread and formatted and all that. And we'll see what happens, but I'm excited. I think it's going to be a good read. Paranormal Apocalypse, Is This How It Ends?
Excellent. I look forward to that, and hopefully I'll get a chance to chew the fat over it and discuss some of the themes included in it with you at a later date, Maxim. But for anybody who wants to keep up to date or get a copy of The Tribes of Bigfoot and some of your previous work, where's the best place to find your books and follow you online, sir?
Yeah, okay, I have a website. It's www.maximfurich.com. And if anybody wants a autographed copy of my book, you know, just, you know, track me down on my website and we could figure something out. I don't know what it costs to ship it over to the UK, but I could figure that out and we can make it right. But, you could also get it on Amazon. But, you know, I tell people, Paul, I tell them this a lot, you know, support your local authors, your local libraries, your local bookstores. You know, Jeff Bezos, the billionaire, does not need, you know, your $20 or your $19.95 or whatever, you know, but I do. And guys like me do. So just, you know, have a little consideration. We're just in the trenches trying to make it work, trying to pay the vig. You know, we're just like everybody else. So.
Absolutely. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes. And once again, always a pleasure. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your conversation. And I look forward to the next time we speak.
Paul, thanks so much. This is great. I really appreciate it. And to all of the listeners in the UK, thank you so much. I am Maxim Furyk. I'm a paranormal author. Take care.